I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is Gary Marshall, legendary director, writer, and producer for movies and television. He's joined in conversation by television critic David Wiegand. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Gary Marshall and David Wiegand. Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Mork and Mindy, The Princess Diaries, Pretty Woman. Gary Marshall has given us many of our most precious movie and TV memories. One of the most successful writer, director, producers in America for over five decades, Gary Marshall is also an actor. Some of his notable film roles include the casino owner in Lost in America, the head of the network in Soap Dish, and Irwin in his son's directorial debut, Keeping Up with the Steins. Here are some things you may not know about Gary Marshall. To say his relationship with his sister Penny was strained during the filming of Laverne and Shirley is a huge understatement. He was inspired to create the iconic character of the Fonz by his best friend at Camp Greenkill in the Catskills. Longtime friend Hector Elizondo has appeared in every film Gary Marshall has ever directed. Gary Marshall joins us tonight with a memoir, My Happy Days in Hollywood, which he co-wrote with his daughter, Lori, who's here tonight. Hi, Lori. He appears in conversation with San Francisco Chronicle executive features editor and TV critic, David Wiegand. Please welcome Gary Marshall and David Wiegand to the JCCSF.
How are you? Hello, hello, we're here. We came. We're here, San Francisco. I don't know if you know that this is Gentile night. Congregational Protestant, Presbyterian Protestant. But I speak a lot of Yiddish, so don't try to fool me. Okay, sir. I'm glad to be here. This is David. He's in charge.
Well, you know, I'm glad to be here, too. I mean, there are a lot of things that I get to do in my career, but I have to say that when I get to talk to someone that I just unabashedly admire and always have, I'm not one of those people who grew up with your TV shows because I was already grown up by the time they were there. But I remember, like, you know, there were so many Marshalls around. You made nepotism a good word, I think, in Hollywood, didn't you?
Yes. Once I found out it was legal, I made it an art form. I said, I'll use everybody. Because it's lonely going to work. But when you see people, you know, oh, I like them. It's not Thanksgiving. I'm hugging. Good. So it's been a good thing. And they all bring something to my work.
Is there anybody in your family that you haven't had as part of your projects ever?
Well, one most reticent was my daughter, Lori, who lives here in San Francisco. Uh-huh. And she was a little girl. She took piano lessons, and she was 7 or 8, and she played not good. So did not just run to it. So, of course, that's what I used. So I put her right in the Odd Couple show to play the piano for Oscar's wedding. I don't know if you remember, because I know she would play badly and they would have trouble walking down the aisle. She played the wedding march worse than ever, got gigantic laughs, but then was not happy after that and never worked again. But she did very well. She wrote the book with me. Is Lori right there? Yeah. She's somewhere in the audience. Where's Lori? Hi, Lori, stand up. Not to hire for piano, but hire for writing.
So, as a kid, you were writing your book that you were kind of sickly. As you were getting sick a lot, what happened? How come you changed and became like an athlete?
I'm still sickly. I have a slight headache now.
Hey,
you gotta understand. I'm a hypochondriac. My wife is a nurse. We've been married 49 years. That's what made the marriage.
That's a secret.
No, I was always sick. If I wasn't sick, I would play. I love playing ball. I played. Yeah. I would get hurt. I had stitches here and there, elbow. Every minute I was in bed. So I spent so much time in bed that I used to kind of think of stories. There wasn't much to do. And there was no TV. And
right.
There was no internet. There was a little thing called the radio. Maybe you remember. And you listened to wonderful shows and used your imagination.
Yeah.
And that's what helped me.
And did you know then that you wanted to write comedy? What did you? Where was comedy in your life at that point?
Well, I liked comedy because it got boring laying there in bed. And but Jack Benny and Fred Allen—I don't know if you remember these shows a while ago—but I liked it. But I was really, my dream was to play shortstop for the New York Yankees.
Yeah.
But I never got. I got a tryout once, but I never made it. And we tried journalism.
Yeah.
I figured my father and mother always said, "You're sickly. You're always going to be sick. You're going to have a headache. You're going to have a stomachache. You're going to bleed a lot. So try to do something while you're bleeding or hurting." And they said, "Writing is good. You could write with your head. No matter how sick, you could write something." And that's what I leaned toward and tried to be a sports writer. And did okay for a while, but eventually... well, to be honest, see, you're always influenced by your environment as you grow up. It twists you. I went to Northwestern University. Terrific school. But they had the worst sports program ever. When I was there, the team football team was 1-11. 1 win, 11 losses. So what are you going to write about? So I made jokes about it. You know, you had to write... You know, by the time the Star Spangled Banner was over, Northwestern was behind 14 points. You know, that's how I let out. And that's what I did. And they said I was funnier than reporting. So that's what I ended up. I mean, I leaned toward it all the way.
Yeah. Well, so then you got a job at the New York Daily News, right? When you got out of school?
Yeah, I got out of school. And it's also your neighborhood. You know, when you're growing up, either you could hit a ball brilliantly, play ball, or you beat people up good, not so good at either. Or else you dress well. I come from a neighborhood where it was Calvin Klein, Ralph Lauren were there, so a snappy dresser, not me. But Ralph Lauren was named Ralph Lifshitz in those days, but... Nobody wanted to buy polo by Lifshitz. So it was no good. So he adjusted. I saw him adjust. So I said, "That's what you do." So I did go to work for the New York Daily News and was not so successful. I mean, I was a copy boy, and then I was a sports statistician. And yet I saw, you know, I would write stuff, and they go, it's all right. But every once in a while, I was a caption writer, you know. And remember... Carmen Basilio was a great boxer, and he got knocked out by Tony Zale. And I wrote the caption as at the front big page was he was knocked out, and I wrote "The Last Act of Carmen." That was the caption. And they called me in. They said, "You wrote this. That's funny. What you wrote, you know?"
Yeah.
And I remember Carl. I think his name was Carl Kane from Iowa. Scored like 40 points in a game, and my caption was "Kane was able." So they kept saying, "Well, he can't write for nothing, but he's funny." So they gave me a lot of assignments where I could use humor.
Yeah,
and you know, like anybody else, you try to find your way.
Yeah. Now you were writing jokes and trying to get comics to use them and so forth at that time, right? You and your partner Fred Freeman, is that right?
Fred Freeman was who I met in college.
Yeah,
and, we wrote for the Northwestern show there, and then we started writing. We had, you know, you try to be clever. We had cards made, said a comedy, 100% virgin material. That's what we had a card. Nobody laughed. Nobody. They threw our card away. Nobody used it. But through it, we met some people. And we met a comedian named Joey Bishop.
Yeah.
Who was a little... He was very funny.
Mm-hmm.
But was a sad guy. He was not a happy... I used to say, Joey would sometimes made every night seem like Yom Kippur. He was always so depressed. But then when they said, go out and work, he was funny. Sinatra loved him, Dean Martin, everybody. So he gave us a start.
Yeah.
Then. He was the first one. And another wonderful comedian named Phil Foster,
right,
who had a bad accent, but you notice I'm not from Alabama. I have an accent, too. So he liked me, and he helped us get started.
Yeah.
And the first job was The Tonight Show.
Right, when Parr was hosting.
Jack
right?
Parr. Remember Jack Parr? He was a nice fella.
Yeah.
And he gave us a little, like a real job. Mm-hmm. But again, because in those days there was no, you know, in the first they used to, years ago they said, are you starving? It was a depression. Then they, my generation, they asked, are you working? Because if you didn't work, you couldn't eat. Now they ask, are you happy? And that's why everybody's messed up trying to be happy. That's a whole other problem. But my generation, you had to be working. And so I literally was working on The Tonight Show, which paid $300 a week. So much money to me. And I worked for The Daily News that paid $45 mm-hmm. a week. So $345 I made. And that's what I worked a while till I had two bylines because my parents thought I was a writer of newspaper writer. So I wrote had two bylines, one about a stamp. It would put you right to sleep. People read all, put everybody to sleep. It was not exciting. And that's when I left. Jack Parr thought everybody was spying on him, so we didn't want anybody working for a newspaper.
Wow.
That's when I left him. He was a very funny and wonderful guy, but he had six writers. But mostly what we were good at is writing ad libs.
Mm-hmm.
So we would stand in the hallway, and he'd walk through the hallway, and he'd see us standing together. He says, guys, don't bunch up like that. Spread out. I don't want everybody to know I have so many writers. Never stand together, you guys, and move us all around. And that's how we grew up, being quiet.
Yeah.
And we wrote for him, though.
All right. And then you went on and wrote for Bishop when he got his sitcom, right? Working for Thomas?
Yes, he went out, Danny Thomas and Joey. Joey Bishop used to do nightclubs, and he'd call us in Chicago and say, come on out. He'd send us a plane ticket. And, of course, we didn't have any money, so we'd cash in the plane ticket and take the bus. We'd go. So we'd get there. We'd get a ride or something. And then he called us Atlantic City. He wants Florida. Finally called from Hollywood, and he said, I need you to come out. I've mm-hmm. got a show. You could come out and punch it up. And I remember saying, I'm sending you a ticket. Don't cash it in. Come now. I need you now. And we flew out and came to Hollywood with a typewriter and a jacket, and that's it. That's all
I had. Was it hard to move from New York to L.A.?
I didn't like L.A.
You didn't?
At all. I've been there, I don't know, 30, 40 years. I'm just getting used to it. No, I didn't unpack for 6 months. It was. I said, I'm just staying a minute, but because I didn't drive. You got to understand, if you're from the Bronx, where I'm from, driving is not a big thing, because to drive, you have to have a car, and nobody could afford a car, so we didn't drive. I 28 years old, I got my license. Everybody, my wife comes from Kentucky, she drove a tractor at 13. She could drive anything. So, needless to say, she drives. I bought the car.
I think that's a good arrangement. you also had a stint writing for Sherry Lewis, which sounds. I'm not quite sure how you adapted to that.
Well, that was an odd job because Saul Turtletaub, a very good writer friend, we knew each other in New York, and he got us a job for Fred and I, and we went. And Sherry Lewis was a very pretty, sweet girl, if you remember, and very delightful. We'd go to her house and say, you want some more? Have a Danish, have a coffee, have a thing. But the puppet she had was Hush Puppy and Lamb Chop. And they were very mean, the two puppets. And Cherry would say, well, it's nice to see you boys. And Lamb Chop would say, what you wrote is terrible. We can't use that. And Hush Puppy would say, crap, crap, crap. Now here's two college graduates talking to two puppets like this. So finally my partner, Fred Freeman, we left one day. He says, I am tired of writing for cloth. I'm not writing for cloth anymore. You can write for cloth by yourself. So we finally left. But it was a nice job. But
yeah.
The puppets were hard. Years later, you see, we learned to, it was very painful, but we learned in life that pain plus time equals humor. We learned that from a great comedian named Lenny Bruce. He said, pain plus time equals humor. So the pain of Jerry Lewis, where we were really let go, weren't paid well. Later on the Dick Van Dyke Show, we wrote an episode about a ventriloquist whose puppet was mean. made a dollar from that.
There you
never
go.
Know. Whatever happens, you can use later.
That's right. Yeah, true. So why don't you tell us how The Odd Couple came about, and that was the first show that you really, that you were the showrunner for, that you really controlled, right?
Well, yeah, we was called executive producer in those days, mm-hmm. and they would come, and it was all mixed up. We did movies. We did a movie called Grasshopper. Mm-hmm. You heard the applause. Nothing. We did another movie called How Sweet It Is. Nothing. So. Not a hit in movies. We were writing them, but they finally called us from Paramount, and they said, we're doing Neil Simon's Odd Couple. You guys want to do it? And we had written for a lot of shows, and Danny Thomas and Dick Van Dyke and all those shows. So we got the job, and first day we got Tony and Jack. I wanted... Tony Randall, and I wanted Jack Klugman, and they said, we know him, and they gave me, we're going to show you film, and they showed me film on Jack Crucian, a totally different guy they were going to hire. So the business is not an exact science. It's quite mixed up. What you hire. They originally wanted Dean Martin and Mickey Rooney. That's who we're casting. I said, you worked with Mickey Rooney lately? You know, there's that Life is Too Short list that he's on. Now, he's a wonderful actor, and I used him in my work. Terrific. But with a series, you could be together a long time. But I remember I'm standing up for a minute. Jack and Tony, I met. We were in New York. And I said, okay, guys. And they're very good. They didn't know each other. And I said, okay, so we're going to shoot the scene. I was directing this too. And I said, so look, all these people want your autograph, and he'd go, and I put them both in a limousine. I said, go in the limousine, you'll sit there. And I got the shot ready, and suddenly in the middle, they both come out of the limousine. They both come up to me, and Tony says, I cannot work with this man. I'm quitting the show. And Jack says, he's crazy as a loon. I can't work with him. What do you... So again, you try as a producer. A producer really equals adult. Somebody has to be an adult. I'm terrific as a kid, but an adult once in a while. And I remember saying, tell me again, what is the problem in the limo? And they said, well, Tony said he smokes. I can't smoke. I have allergies. I go, he made that noise. And we can't work together. So we learned early in our experience that sometime when there's a problem, one of the things is you throw money at it. And whoever throws the less money at it gets hired more often. So I quickly got another limo and got two limos. I put Jack in one limo, Tony in the other limo. And that's how they worked for 5 years in separate places and worked very well together. But that's how the show almost didn't even get started, just because I had to solve the coughing and sneezing problem, which I knew very well. I know how to do that. I've done that most of my life. But that got on and wasn't a live audience, and we finally made a live audience, and it became big. Never was number one.
I today I find that so impossible to believe.
But it was always in the top 20, and there was always marketing and people, and there was a whole thing about, there's two guys on the show, people think they're gay. That's a whole thing like that. So, of course, when that happens, you have to, make them crazy a little bit. So we used to shoot special scenes where Tony and Jack used to hug and kiss and run, and we'd send it to the network. We thought we'd try this week. What do you think? And they would get hysterical and crazy and come running around like nuts. And then we put, but nobody cared. It had nothing to do with that.
Right.
And we had girls, but it became a solid show. And I must say, if you watch The Odd Couple, we did in 1970 to 75, 5 years, it holds up pretty good today.
Oh, yeah.
If you see an Odd Couple, pretty funny to this day.
Yeah.
I got to say. And I say that for Tony and Jack.
Well, I think you had something to do with that, too. Don't you think so?
I was there. Well, I tried to make peace very often.
You're listening to movie and television director, writer, and producer Gary Marshall, who's joined in conversation by television critic David Wiegand on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Do you have a favorite episode of The Odd Couple?
Well, there's a lot of them. And again, I try to keep a happy set and keep people in a good mood because, you know, it's work and you want to get them to do their best and they'll do their best in a better mood. So I remember they were complaining that the scripts were getting integrated and there were speeches and Tony would say, "This speech here is too long for me. I think I can do it with a look." How are you going to do it with a look? You got to say 8:30, 9:30, 10:30. You can't say that with a look. Carried on. So finally I said, all right, do this show. And they did a show that was very good and very well done. They acted it beautifully. And I said, here, everybody take the week off. And I purposely wrote a show where Tony and Jack, the two of them, they go away, they're stressed out, and they go away to a monastery for peace and quiet. And they get to the monastery, and they're told they can't speak. So they spoke in the first scene, they spoke in the last scene. That was it. The whole rest of the show was all mime and pants. It was very funny.
Yeah, yeah.
But they didn't have to learn any lines.
Yeah.
So they were so happy from that they did all the next shows very well.
Now, speaking of nepotism, I believe that was the first time you hired your sister on a show. Is that right? Is that Penny's first appearance?
Yes, my mother was calling. She's dating badly. Get her a job, for Christ's sake. But there's always a mother involved, no matter what. But Penny knew Jack Klugman. She did some other. Then came Bronson, one of those strange shows with Jack, and he knew her. And we had to hire somebody for to be the secretary.
Right.
And Tony didn't like hiring relatives. He was still mad at Laurie for playing the piano. He hated kids altogether. But finally, Jack Klugman helped me get Penny on the show, and they taught her a lot about how to act and how to behave. And so when she brought this kid, Rob Reiner, on the show, and they later got married.
Yeah.
And so that's what started her going. And she did well.
Oh,
and,
she's great.
And
great.
And my mother left me alone a minute. No, she was happy. And Penny liked it, but then quit and became a writer.
Yeah.
Penny and Cindy were writers by the time we did Laverne and Shirley.
Laverne and Shirley, yeah.
Yes.
I guess, I don't know, Happy Days must be the TV show that most people remember best. How long was that on?
11 seasons.
Wow.
It's a long time.
It doesn't happen anymore.
Longer than most marriages in college and high school. It's been on a long time. And but that was a happy bunch of people. There's something about some people glass half filled or empty, whatever it is. Some people feel good. They're working. They're blessed. And look at that. We're very fortunate. And the Happy Days cast felt like that. They were nice people. They're people you could go to lunch with. Mm-hmm. Henry Winkler still is one of the better human beings I know in the show business, as is Ron Howard. And again, you weather the storms, and I play a lot of softball. I'm a little nuts with that. I play seniors now. You ever play, anybody play senior softball? Oh, it's terrific. It's if you get a double, they let you take a nap. You know, it's terrific. No, it's one of my favorites. The old guys, there's no championship trophy. The winner of the championship gets free Lipitor. They say, here's what you get. You don't get a trophy. Take a picture, take a pill. But anyway, on Happy Days, there was a whole move. Everything is crazy. The whole move. We're changing the show to Fonzie. You know, Fonzie is good. Right. We've got to change the name, Fonzie. And I try to avoid sitting in offices. So we're playing softball. We had a Happy Day softball team. We played all over the world. And I'm playing. We're warming up. And I said to Ron Howard, I'm throwing. And I said, they want to change the show to Fonzie. You heard that? And he said, yeah. I said, well, I don't think that's good. I think, you know, I'd have to quit. And Ron said, yeah, I have to quit too. And so then Henry wasn't such a ball player. We taught him. Ron Howard bought him his first baseball glove, and he pitched, and he pitched pretty good. So then we went to him in the dugout and said, you know, Fonzie, we would think if they called it Fonzie, we'd have to leave. What do you think? He said, I'd leave too, and that was it. We never discussed again, and that was the end of it. Yeah. But it's better than sitting there having a meeting in an office. We just did most of our trouble on that show on the softball field, honestly.
But you honestly see that all in the show, too, the sense that this is a bunch of people who really like working together.
Yeah, they did it. And a lot was this director we had named Jerry Paris, whose kids I was talking about, Julie, went to Emerson College. And Jerry was a great director and made them all bond together. And we went through Tom Bosley, the father. His wife passed away during it. The other kids met, got married, and Erin Moran, the young girl, you know, it's different being an actress. She graduated high school in a little room with me and her. They said, hello, here's your diploma. That was her graduation, one kid in a room.
Yeah.
So they come out a little cockeyed from those experiences, but some survive and some don't. But that was a happy bunch. Everybody kind of bonded together. And that's what made the show, I think, the most fun I ever had with the show.
And then there's Laverne and Shirley. What was that set like compared to Happy Days?
There was a headache. Boy, what? See, there are some people who feel today you got a lot of people who are entitled to things. They have no entitlement, but they think they do. But those days you had two types of applicants, those who worked hard and say, boy, I'm lucky I got this job. And the others, who all seem to be on Laverne Shirley, would say, I don't deserve this. They're going to find out. They're going to fire me. It's terrible. I'm not really so good and this and that. And they were that kind of negative thing. And it's very hard to get them out of it. They weren't dating well at the time. And you can't change them. I remember we had a live audience, and after one episode, the audience stood up and cheered. They were so good, Penny and Cindy. They were like geniuses, did all their own stunts. Yeah. And they're clapping and they're standing. And I said to Penny and Cindy, isn't this great? Look, there's... And Penny said, yeah, but what am I going to do tonight? And Cindy said, we have no dates. We have no place to go. As Penny always said, and my hair is no good. My hair is terrible. I couldn't get her to stop worrying about her hair. It all came from one of her first jobs, Penny, was a shampoo commercial. And she was the girl in the commercial with bad hair, dandruff. And the girl with the good hair was Farrah Fawcett, actually. One of the true stories. And so when they lit when they liked, they bring in stand-ins.
Yeah,
and they don't have names in a commercial, so they put a nice thing around Farrah's stand-ins thing that said pretty girl, and around Penny's it said homely girl. So Penny can read, she saw. But Farrah, in her kindness, said, oh, that's not nice. So she came over and she crossed out homely and wrote plain. And they've been friends up till the poor lady passed on. But they were friends for life. Yeah. But that's what started with the hair. So every show, a hair's not good and the whole thing... you can't get change them from that.
And it didn't make any difference that Penny's your sister in terms of being able to control things on that set?
Well, you control things, but Penny's... You see, at some point you say, okay, we'll fix it tomorrow, good night. But Penny's my sister, she'd follow me home. You know, she knew where I lived. You gotta... And my wife would say, Penny's outside, she's ringing, she's going to climb over the gate if you don't answer. She's going to answer. And she came in and she sat down at supper and said, the second act is terrible, let's fix it. But they were perfectionists.
Yeah.
But it just was really hard because the whole rest of the cast, Lenny Squee, all became terrific. But they were not happy. Nobody was happy on no matter what. And no matter what happened on Happy Days, they were happy. It was just a change. Then the next one was a different story.
Yeah.
But so you got to deal with whatever you got to deal with, and it's none are the same.
Can you explain what the... I want to go back to Happy Days for 1 minute to ask you about Jumping the Shark and how that came about and what that means in the TV world.
Jumping
today.
The Shark is nice to know that I'm part of the vernacular, and I'm not ashamed of it. It was good. We were stuck. We were supposed to go to Hawaii. You know, they always think they're going to do something. And then somebody looks at the budget and said, you're not going to Hawaii. You'll go to Malibu Beach. You'll sit on the beach. I said, it's not Hawaii. They all think they're going to Hawaii. No, they're not going. So we had to do it on a beach, and we didn't have anything to do. So it was part of my idea. I said, well, he's got to jump something. We had done very well with Fonzie jumping over garbage cans. Yeah, Fonzie never jumped. You know, there was always a double for him. He's not such a motorcycle driver. He can act the beginning of the ride and the end. The middle comes a guy named Murray. Hello, you'll put on the helmet and you'll go. He did all the jumping. But then the same thing, I said, you got a water ski, Henry. We can't put a helmet on you. Cause you got, well, no, I can do that. So he did water ski, and he actually jumped the shark, which was a little bit over the top, even for us. But we did it because we needed something special to happen in that episode, and it did fine. Now, somebody wrote Jumping the Shark was when it went downhill, and maybe it did. It was not our finest hour, Jumping the Shark. But it was a nice phrase, and the show ran 4 more years. It wasn't, like, over. But now all the shows have a Jumping the Shark moment, and we can usually tell what it is. The audience will let you know.
Yeah, but it usually happens a lot earlier these days than it did then.
In 3 weeks, it jumps the shark, and good night. It's all right. But the, I mean, Mork and Mindy did a, we were great the first couple of years, and then we went, they moved us again. Too much competition, and again, you adjust to each show. I remember Robin Williams was on Happy Days. We got to get a guy for Happy Days, and my sister Ronnie, also nepotism, one of the best, that produced all our shows and cast, and she found this guy to play an alien. We were running out of adversaries for Fonzie, and they said, bring in an alien. And my son said, I don't like Happy Days. Why? He was 7. He said, there's no space people. I said, it's 1950s. There was no space. But like any kid, they understand. And I said, how am I going to do that? And he said, it's a dream. And that's what we did. We made it a dream that he dreamed about Mork coming down, and we hired Robin because Ronnie found him. And I remember saying, what's he done? You know, what's his credits?
Right,
and
right.
They said, well, she said, well, he does pantomime. He stands on a street corner, and he passes a hat, and he makes noises and does pantomime. I said, that's what he's done so far? She said, yeah. I said, Ronnie, why would we choose him again? Tell me. And she said, it's an awful full hat. At the end of the day, he can't some money. So we brought him in, and he did his audition on standing on his head, and he was wonderful. But he was a genius. We put him on Happy Days, and the audience stood up and applauded after the thing. But I remember the first time we got up, we had the pilot. And Robin is, you know, a special guy. And he used to work here at the Hungry Eye. When the first time I saw him in San Francisco with the Brothers Karamazov. They're juggles. And anyway, so Robin starts. And at Paramount at the time, there's three cameramen, right? And the average age is like 85. You know, they got cameras. And they sit like this with the cameras. And my one and three, and my best was Sam. I love Sam. Sam sat with his camera. I said, okay, here we go. This is a new guy, Robin Williams. This is his show. First smoking. Okay, let's rehearse the scene. And then Robin said, okay, and then action. And he ran, and he jumped, and he did what was in the script, and he ad-libbed what wasn't in the script, and he jumped over the couch, around the thing, all over. Brilliant. And I yelled, cut. And I said, you get that, Sam? And Sam said, he never came by here. I said, Sam, the man is a genius. He's a genius. And Sam said, if he's such a genius, he can hit that mark there, he'll be on the television. We added a fourth camera just to follow Robin. That was one of the first four cameras we ever used, was Robin Wee. But he adjusted, and he became brilliant.
We should move into some of the movies at this point. So many great movies. I've been really thrilled. Last night I watched Clinton speaking, and then after he was done, I turned over, and there was on ABC Family, they're showing Pretty Woman. And
politics followed by a hooker often
absolutely.
Works.
And that happens in life,
it's
too.
A combo. You need a combo.
What did you think when you got that script? I mean, here's a script about, you know, a very high-priced call girl and so forth. I mean,
a lot of times it's an adjustment. I mean, I've done some independent ones that, you know, sometimes independent without the studio. People ask me, one of my favorite pictures is called The Other Sister, a difficult subject. Mm-hmm. I made it with independent and Disney. But these studio pictures are big money, and they got to have this. And they hired me. They had a script called Beaches, and they hired me. They said, this is very depressing about two women who are really sick, and one dies. It's all depressing. So I said, so what do you want me to do? They said, well, you'll lighten it up a little bit. You'll make it a little funnier. And so we got Bette Midler, and we did. It was funny and of course, very sad. And I knew if you're going to go sad, my theory is you got to get the right music to go sad. So we got the right song in Beaches, and it did very well. Yeah. And it's not always what the guy's going to see, but it proved to be everybody came, and it did well. And I have an assistant who lives in Indiana, and his house was robbed. The robbers came in, and they took all the family's DVDs, except they left one. They left Beaches. And the police said, must be male robbers. Let's look up a male guy. So it has a reputation, Beaches. But after Beaches, they said, here's the same story about an old prostitute who's on her last legs, and a guy tries to help her. And it was really a heavy thing at the end. It was called 3,000, and because that's how much money he gave her. And then at the end, she falls in love, and he says, I'm not in love with you. Here's your money. And she takes the money and throws it in his face, and he smacks her, and she falls out on the ground. And then she goes up to her apartment, and her roommate is ODing and dies. So I said, you read it, Gary? I cried a little. So what are we going to do with this one? And they said, well, we'll make it a younger girl and you'll make it a little lighter.
Oh,
and so we did the rewrite. It was a wonderful script written by Jonathan Lawton, who mm-hmm. got the credit for it. He wrote it beautiful. We just kind of lightened it up and made up an ending and got a better ending out of it. And we didn't know what we had, but Julia Roberts was pretty terrific. And Richard Gere, who in the middle said, you know, she's very good, this kid. I never heard of her. But you don't need me. You just need my suit. Why don't you get somebody with my suit? I'll go home. And I said, no, Richard, you help her a lot. And they did get along very well.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features movie and television director, writer, and producer Gary Marshall, who's joined in conversation by television critic David Wiegand. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
That scene with the jewelry case, that was she didn't know that was she it was going to
no no you know
face,
again
right?
When people, it gets boring every day getting up at 4:30 and coming to work and they don't pay attention, so sometimes I do pranks and do crazy things and it keeps them awake. When Julia was in the bathtub, she goes under the water for a minute, so I got everybody ready, and then she went underwater and we disappeared. The whole crew case, everybody was gone. She came up from the water and looked around. What happened? She thought it was a fire or something. She didn't hear. So she started to get out. She didn't have clothes on. It was a big deal.
Well, let's see if people in the audience have some questions. I'm sure they do.
Hi. Do you prefer big screen or small screen for directing or writing or your craft in general?
Well, I thought I was in television. I thought I'm going to get that big screen and I'll learn how to use the whole screen. Jacques Tati was a big influence on me, where he used the whole screen and where he had the pace. The movie pace is different than TV pace. But now I know I worked so hard to make a big screen picture, and the kids are watching it on their telephone. They're like this at a bus stop. Ooh, I'll watch what the hell, New Year's Eve. Well, that's good. So you can't win. I like the big screen the way it was meant to be, but you got to see what's going to go on. I think anything can tell a story. Cavemen drew it on the wall. Here, let's go to Murray's cave. He'll put it on the wall. It'll be good. The thing. And but whatever, wherever story works.
Yes, Mr. Marshall, I wonder, since you grew up in the golden age of television, what you think about the impact of cable and some of the art forms that we have today, like reality shows and that sort of thing, how you think that's affected the quality of programming and so on.
Well, reality shows are a little, you know, it's let's laugh at my neighbor. That's what I'll do. And regular people, and you know, mockery has always been a big part of humor. And so to make fun of people is good. And they found that the business, always, no matter what happens in the creative, it's the business. They learned to make reality shows without hiring expensive writers, and they could get actors cheap, and a few snooky asked for more money. But most of the people, they don't know. They don't give much. And there is a phenomenon now with those kind of shows. If you watch all cable, you know, I just did a show. I'm very hip. What did I just do? Louis C.K. You know Louis C.K.? I just did that show because I know him. He's a funny guy. So I played the boss on that show. But it's all, you see the other channels, the sexuality is a whole thing now. And good, bad, whether you like it, whether you don't, I come from a different generation. It was not, we'll talk about sex for 2 seconds. It was not... In the 50s, the women had this ability, because I don't know if you remember, I see some of you older, the women, they had skirts. So, ooh, we're going to look up their skirt and the thing. And but they had this thing called crinoline, which was under the skirt, right? Now you put your hand under there, it was not, you didn't know where to go. You couldn't. It was like Lewis and Clark. You couldn't find the goddamn thing. Where is the promised land? I don't know. I can't find this. And then they had, finally, if you got through it all, you came to another thing, which they no longer have, but it was called a panty girdle. Do you remember that? Panty girdle was very tight. So finally, you would maybe get your hand there. You get by the panty girdle, but the panty girdle was very tight, and your hand would go numb. You couldn't feel anything. The girl from the 50s, they didn't know. They were, oh, they didn't know what they were doing. This guy had a numb hand. Oh, and then I just remember, so the lovely girl, Sue Gail Merck, her name was, and I pulled my hand out, and my watch was missing. I couldn't find the damn watch. I laid in her lap to see if she had that. I could hear ticking, nothing. Never had sex with this girl. Lost my watch. That was the 50s sex. A totally different thing. Next question.
Next question is up here to your right.
Okay. Shirley Feeney, Laverne DeFazio. Those weren't Jewish girls, but when they start skipping down the street at the beginning of the show, they say, Shlemiel, Shlemazel. Where'd that come from?
Well, we in the Bronx, we grew up in a kind of Italian-Jewish neighborhood, and we didn't have much money, so we made up games. We had one Spalding ball. We played 50 games, and I remember we were shooting. See, everything evolves. Nobody's sure. We did a little pilot scene for Laverne and Shirley in the Happy Days set. The Happy Days audience was done. The show was over. I said, you want to stay? We're going to shoot a piece for a new show. And Laverne and Shirley, we got in the set. Fonzie's apartment we used. And they did a little something. And then there's always a man who calls the head of the studio. And they said, well, they did it. It was only seven minutes long. But it was kind of funny. So now it's midnight. Now, I always believe life is more important than show business. So my wife came to pick me up. It was a Friday night, so she got three kids in the car. And she said, let's go. We're going to Palm Springs. And I said, the head of the studio said, shoot some titles. What titles? Well, shoot like an opening. What are we going to... It's midnight. So I took the camera out in the street. I said, honey, I can't go now. What am I going to do? I got three kids in the car. I said, they'll sleep. It'll be nice. They'll sleep. So they went to sleep. My wife is sitting there honking every once in a while. Are you done yet? This is not the way to do art with a honking wife and three kids. But because I had promised that we'd leave at 9 o'clock. It was my fault. Anyway, so I'm talking to Ronnie. I said, what are we going to do? Titles. What can we do? So Ronnie says, that's my other sister, says, well, remember the walk Penny and I used to do when we were not talking to Mom and Dad? We used to do that walk. What was the walk? She said, well, we said Shlemiel, Shlemazel. You know, it was a combination of the Jewish people in the apartment. Everybody did that. So Cindy said, what are you talking about? What means Shlemiel? This is not, this is Gentile of the Year, Cindy Williams. It's not from the neighborhood. So literally at midnight on the Paramount lot, we taught Cindy how to do that walk. We shot that walk. We got to there. And because I was trying to keep my wife busy, she wrote a little sign that said Laverne and Shirley on a piece of cardboard. And they finished, they walk, and a sign was sitting there. They walked by the sign. We hailed the sign. That was the titles. That was temporary, just for the night to get out of there. They liked it so much, it became the whole title. Wow. Nobody knew what it meant. Hoss and Pfeffer, it's gibberish. In the Bronx, you talk gibberish just so your parents wouldn't know what you were saying. This is what you did to your family. Yeah. But that was just good luck. We don't know why.
Gary, you're known for, and they've emphasized in the introduction to questions, your comedy. But you've had some serious thoughts about American culture and have done that in your movies. You might want to talk about that.
Culture. I remember culture. It's a good thing. No, we try to do some serious things and you alternate with the studios. I did a picture called Nothing in Common, Jackie Gleason and Tom Hanks. Very serious picture, did very well. Look, four people clap. Pretty Woman, yay! No, four people, it's all right. But you got to balance it, truly. You try to bring in, even in a comedy, you try to bring in a little serious stuff. But Nothing in Common was serious. The Other Sister, about a mentally challenged girl, was very serious. One of my favorites was just the wrong time. You know, a lot of times it's, you know, watch the competition. But a lot of times a show is, or a hit is, a certain time in history, what the culture is like. And I remember I did a TV show about recruiting men in the Army and Navy and Marines, because there was a recruiting place where they were all there. It was good comedy. But I did it right in the middle of the Vietnam War, and it was terrible. Nobody wanted. People are burning their draft cards. I'm doing a picture about recruiting. Same thing with the culture now that... lately, if you've seen pictures, you see slackers are very popular. Young people with no place to do. They don't want to do anything. To be cool, you have no job. And helicopter, you know, parents and boomerang kids, they go back home. So these are some of the cultural themes that I got a new picture I hope to do in the spring. It's called Mothers, because I think one of the hardest things today is to be a mother. Yeah, because in my day, you wondered if the kids this is the rules. You do this, whatever, your kid's mad, so what? Now, the whole culture, there was a good article in the New Yorker magazine about spoiled rotten, is now all the mothers are worried, does the kids like me? Am I giving them space? Am I They're 4 years old, they know nothing. But... am I doing the right thing? Did I have to go to gymnastics, then swimming, then go, then speak a language? They're little kids. They talk. Well, let's see if they can in another language. this is all a part of what is there. And I remember I did a picture called Frankie and Johnny, which was really a serious thought written by Terrence McNally, yeah. a wonderful playwright. And, of course, the studio said, okay, we'll get Bellman and this and Smith and get Silverman and they'll write it. I said, no, why don't you let the man write it? He wrote the play, Frank. Well, he never wrote a movie. I said, so what? Let him try. And I remember I put up my money so they'd hire him to write the movie. He wrote a beautiful script. Yeah. Frank, yeah, Al Pacino, Michelle Pfeiffer. And anyway, that was a picture that I was very proud of. And we did, you know, it did well. And got a lot of pictures got terrific reviews, and some didn't. Some of the most popular pictures I've done have not gotten good reviews. Pretty Woman, they changed their mind. First, they buried it, but it came back.
Last question right here. I'm sorry.
Are you bored? You want me to?
No.
Last question right here in the front to your right, Gary.
I'm
lost. Can you please tell us a little bit about Lucille Ball?
Lucille Ball. Yeah, I was. I've been very fortunate that coming up in the business, I worked for some of the best of the best. And I got to work for Lucy because, you know, when you're first starting out, you can't be above everything. You know, people, you say, well, that's beneath me. I said, you're 23 years old. There's nothing beneath you. What do you mean beneath you? How did you get anywhere? You got to take a chance, you know. Well, I want to... People worry too much. I was taught, always take what everything. And it was a lot of charity shows in those days. The Writers Guild had a charity. And stars would come and do charity. And I wrote some material for a skit. And Lucille Ball ended up doing the skit. And the thing that is the cardinal rule of comedy, if you write something for somebody in comedy and it gets a laugh, they never forget you. They forget your name, they forget, but they know how to find you. They will find you again. And I wrote this skit for Lucille Ball. She got some laughs, and then her and Desi, you know, Desi invented the three-camera audience technique because he understood you couldn't repeat comedy. you couldn't do it again in a funny way and fall down. So he invented three cameras for Lucy, so three cameras would get her doing the funny chocolate thing and the funny grapes and all of that. So anyway, he left, and they had a party, and then Lucy Ball did her own show, and a friend of mine became the producer, and he said, you want to hire this kid? And she said, I don't know this kid. He said, he once did a skit for you at the Writers Guild. That kid, I got to laugh. Who is that kid? And she brought me on, and I remember, I tell this because, you know, everything's not perfect. One script I wrote for her, and I saved it. She wrote in big letters, this is shit on my thing. Right, I have that. I'm going to sell it someday on Amazon. But right now, it's there. And again, it's not fun, but you go back and you try to make it better. And I remember we rewrote it, and it was better. And then we wrote another show for where she was, you always, with Lucy, different from every other show. With Lucy, every show you write, well, here's the premise, and this is how the story will go. Lucy always started with the last scene. You say, what's the last scene when she does something spectacular physically? So we thought it'd be funny, the last scene, she's in a formal gown going to a formal ball, and they announce her, but she has roller skates on. So when they announce her, they announce her, she comes in and she flies across the room on the roller skate. And then we wrote to that, to get to that. And so we went to the rehearsal of that, and she came out, and they announced she had the roller skates, and she comes flying in. So the rehearsal, she comes flying in, and two waiters are supposed to go by, and she goes under the table. Well, it didn't work in rehearsal. She went, and she smashed right into the table, right on the ground. And I'm standing there, and I'm saying, well, I killed Lucy. That's my reputation. That's my contribution to comedy in this century. I killed the best one there is. But I remember going over to her and saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And she said, no, it was my fault. We mistimed it. She said, you keep writing it. It's good stuff. You'll be all right. And she gave me a hug and did it again. And it was really one of the highlights of ever working with her. And she was always fun, but, you know, a taskmaster. And everything she ever taught me, I taught my sister Penny and Cindy. That's why they do such great physical comedy. But thank you for asking. Julie Andrews and Lucille Ball are two of the best people I've ever worked with, two of the really ladies of the industry.
Thanks to all of you, and thanks mostly to Gary Marshall.
Thank you.
Good
very
night.
Much. David, thank you
so much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was movie and television director, writer, and producer Gary Marshall, who was joined in conversation by television critic David Wiegand. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia and David Kwan. David Kwan also edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon, when Bina will feature Ted Allen, host of the Food Network show Chopped, and whose latest book is In My Kitchen, 100 Recipes and Discoveries for Passionate Cooks. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.